And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Thank you, Claude. It is Chatter on Books. It is our 41st episode, which is just stunning, and we are coming close on the one-year anniversary of Chatter on Books. It should be fabulous. I have to think of some anniversary party. We have a terrific show tonight, and we have a really unusual, really remarkable book and a remarkable author sitting to my right, Tope Falerin. Gene and I were trading emails all weekend long going, this is really good. Yeah. This is really good. And then when we come to focusing just on you, Tope, there were sections where I just started going, wait a minute. Is this him for real, or is this him, his character, or is this character
sure,
having schizophrenic thoughts? It was amazing.
Yeah.
So remarkable.
Is it the character or
really
that
remarkable
character that's remembering things incorrectly? Yeah. And yeah.
I can't remember what and how I wrote something on a grocery list. How you kept that going is remarkable.
We've so got in other words, don't touch that dial. Don't there's excitement galore coming up in the next hour.
And
here
that was
Chatter
not Bill
Books.
Curtis, because we can't afford Bill Curtis on Chatter on Books. We got some random thoughts. We do not have David. That was Jamie McIntyre. David, God bless him, is on his way to Houston to cover the Nats, which we hope will go very, very well. A little bit of a debate on literary awards. And Tope, you are an award winner, so you can weigh in on that conversation. There are pros and cons.
There are
definitely pros and cons.
I think about this all the time.
Yeah,
so,
and when you win your Nobel, we'll bring you back
Say
it all started here.
Here.
And Deserted Island is going to be the result of some conversations with Claire, who happens to be here this evening at the undisclosed location, some personal recommendations of books for people. But before anything else, Calvert Woodley, I didn't make it there today. It was my bad. Our wonderful sponsor at 4339 Connecticut Avenue, and Michael's a little under the weather, so that causes problems. So we do not have wine and cheese this evening from them. But it's a great place, and everybody
and
should go.
I have to say, I got the catalog that Michael's been working on for so long.
He goes into not hibernation. He goes into seclusion for the month of September.
And he should.
His catalog.
I mean, it is really a work of art. I know nothing about wine, but I just go through this catalog, and it's
beautiful.
Beautifully produced.
Huh. It goes to 43,000 people.
Wow.
People wait for it the way Gene might remember this, but remember when the fall Vanity Fair came out? What a big deal that was.
Yes.
Or Vogue. Fall Vogue.
September Vogue.
Yeah. Go Tope.
Yeah.
Metrosexual you.
Nice. Love the September Vogue.
Nice.
There's a movie about it called September Vogue. Yes.
I've seen it.
43,000 people await the catalog from Calvert Woodley. There's a beautiful photograph on the front from that Michael has taken. And inside, they have a wonderful box on Chatter on Books.
That's
the official sponsor up.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Michael. So go there. And now, and also, he's changed the promotional code. It's now Nationals 5.
Okay.
Till the end of October. And if you use Nationals 5 and you go, you get $5 off your bill.
All right.
And he swears that in checkout they know that. So that's terrific. Jamie, Nats, how are you feeling?
So,
how's Roberta feeling? Your better half?
Yeah, so Roberta snagged us tickets to Game 3, so we're looking forward to that.
I could say something really inappropriate about how she got that, but I won't. But
you don't want to know.
Yeah.
But you know the big controversy now that's just erupted about the Nats and whether or not the Astros will do something diabolical and force the Nats not to be able to wear their blue uniforms.
How can they do that?
Well, so the home team gets to pick what color they wear, and the Astros have been wearing their home whites, and they've been doing really well. I think they're 5-1 in their last game. So, you know, because baseball players, this is going to come as a shock, but they're very superstitious. So, you know, the Nats haven't changed their alternate navy blues since they went on this streak. And so they've been winning in this uniform, so everybody wants them to stay in the navy blue. But if the Astros also have an alternate navy blue. They also have an alternate orange uniform. And if they were to pick their alternate blue for the home games in Houston, the Nats would have to wear a different color. They might have to wear red.
But if the white's working for Houston, why would they change?
So
just to mess with
this
gets
to my larger point, though, about whether or not we're really rational as human beings.
I haven't changed my clothes since they clinched the division, so...
So,
well, you know where I am on that.
Because, of course, this is...
Don't worry,
you know,
you're not down with...
One of the things I like to think about a lot is how we as human beings are not really all that rational. We think we're rational, but we're not really. And one of the cognitive biases we have, these thinking errors that we have in our daily life, is the classic correlation is not causation. Just because two things happen together, just because they win in the blue, doesn't really mean the blue has any power to help the Nats win. But we kind of believe it anyway.
No, here's the other rule. If something happens once, what? No big deal. If something happens twice, it's a coincidence. If something happens three times, it's for real.
It's a trend.
It's a very small data set that you're working with. But you remember, do you remember the Budweiser commercial they had? They had a whole series of these where the tagline was, "It's only weird if it doesn't work."
Yes.
Do you remember that they were these guys? They're in the stands and somebody's going to kick the game-winning field goal, and somebody says, "Labels out."
Yeah.
Everybody put labels out, and the guy says, "Like what? What are we doing? Like labels out? The smoothness of the label creates a connection to the ball in the field, and it guides it through." And he's like, "Well, you know, whatever." And he holds it up, and they're like, "Sure enough."
Well,
it's
only weird
if it doesn't work.
I think it was a wild card game. Brian and Colin, our oldest son, were at the game, and when we first got there, they went to get Goose Island beers. And I looked at them. I said, "That is what we drink at hockey games. We're big, Tope. We are big into hockey."
Sure.
I said, "That is our hockey beer. What are you doing?" And they kind of sneered at me. And I go right for the Devil's Backbone. And after the second inning of that game, they went back up, traded in their Goose Island for Devil's Backbone, and look what happened.
Well, so, I would go down the basement to get a beer, and while I would be gone, they would score. I would come every time.
Roberto would say, "Go back to the basement."
I have to go to the basement. I said, "Well, I want to watch the game. Just like, this is for the win. Go down to the basement."
Ms. McManus, how are you feeling?
Well, I have good news. If you're a native Washingtonian, which I am, if you went to baseball games in Griffith Stadium, which I did, if you watched one Washington baseball team get stolen and go to Minneapolis, which I did, if you watched another baseball team get stolen and go to Texas, which I did, you get free tickets from Major League Baseball to all of the World Series games. Isn't that wonderful?
Wow.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. No, it's my total.
Okay. You had me go for
it. Somebody's keeping track of that. That would be really good.
I'm due.
But you have to use the promo code NATSPOT.
That's right. We were talking before the show, and it's probably gone up by now. If you wanted a seat right behind home plate today, $22,000.
Wow.
If you want standing room only, Gene.
Wait, did you say 2,200 or
22,000?
22,000. 800 for standing room only.
Wow.
I wouldn't pay over 20,000, frankly.
That's fair.
I just wouldn't.
It's
that's
a
just
decent
me.
Cutting off point, I think.
Okay, how many games does it go?
Five.
As many as it takes.
I say six. Tope?
Six.
Yeah.
Six.
Claude,
yeah.
How many games?
Six.
Yeah. Just to really drag it out and really torture us.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to be in Michigan this weekend for all three of the World Series games, which we wouldn't go anyhow because we're not going to pay $22,000 or $800 a ticket. But I'm kind of bummed that we won't be here because it is fun in this town when stuff like that is going on.
But, Tori, you and I were in game four. I'm not sure if I could go through another game like that again. There were moments where I just had to sit down and put my head in my hands.
Oh, the first inning, you're screaming, you're yelling, you're hugging absolute perfect strangers. And for the rest of the game, you're holding their hands, just clutching them, going, "It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay." Just absolute white faces, trying to pretend like it was all okay. It wasn't. Well, Sunday would be the last game. Game five. Okay.
Yeah. And then it would go back to Houston for six,
a couple days later.
Yeah,
in town it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay.
They offer Monday, and then the last two games would be Tuesday
out there
and Wednesday in Houston.
Maybe we'll have David call
and
tape.
They're going to close the top of the stadium, even though it's supposed to be beautiful weather in Houston. They're going to close the top because
why?
You know, they don't want anybody complaining that shadows or weird things happened with the ball, or they want ideal conditions.
Well, we want it warm for Strasburg. That's good.
He does 72 like degrees.
Yeah, exactly.
Tony has taken away the moniker, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
He's no longer the orchid.
The orchid, yeah.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. Okay. Speaking of accomplishments, those who listen to the show or listen to Tony's show know my dad, who is almost 98 years old, reads voraciously, has been reading the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he informed me the other day he's gotten through Z. He started at the beginning. He's gotten through Z. It's good and bad news. Claire's giving it a thumbs up because this could be, he just could say, "I'm done now. I am done. He's been saying that for 20 years, but now he might just go, yeah.
Ingested the sum of human knowledge, right?
Yeah.
I don't know about your dad, but if it was me and I got to Z, I would no longer remember anything by A through K.
Start over again.
I know that because I watched the new Breaking Bad movie, the sequel.
How was it?
El Camino. And I realized when I went to watch it, I didn't remember. I don't remember what happened in Breaking Bad. I thought, I'm going to have to go watch Breaking Bad before I watch this movie.
Was it? It's not standalone? You can sort of...
It's like if they made two more episodes to tell you what happened to Jesse Pinkman, so they really wrap it up. But they do a little, you know, previously on Breaking Bad, and they kind of in about 4 minutes try to whip you through the whole series of Breaking Bad. I couldn't remember anything.
Okay, do you watch Succession?
Yes.
Love that show.
What's you on? What season?
Love that show. I finished. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, such a literary giant. I love it.
Here's the only thing I can tell you about. I'm going through withdrawal right now. I was sad when.
Yes, when you're done.
Yeah, I'm
but
upset.
Here's the only thing I can tell you about the season finale, season two of Succession.
Oh, we can't spoil. That's true.
Yeah, there will be a season three.
Yes.
Well, that's all I can tell you.
I hope so, because there will be no reason for me to live if there isn't. It's so good.
It's incredible. It's delicious, isn't it?
In Breaking Bad, you could like some of them, right? Mm-hmm. You hate every single person on Succession and everything they stand for and every behavior they have. And you can't tear your eyes away.
You hate them in different categories.
Yeah.
You know,
at different times.
Yeah. But aren't you kind of rooting for some of them a little bit? I mean, a little bit?
For whom are you rooting?
Well, I don't want to spoil a thing, but I mean, Kendall throughout has been, you know, the object of some derision from, and so I think in the context of his family, his father looking down on him, the fact that he can never do well enough by his father.
Mm-hmm.
So when he does succeed at certain points, mm-hmm. If you take him out of his context, which is, you know, somebody who has perhaps way too much money and is doing all kinds of horrible things, but within the context of his family, he is triumphing in a way that he hasn't been able to before. And so I think there's a part of you as a human being that relates to that journey.
Yeah.
Right.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brian and I have...
He's still a loathsome character.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. But in some ways, I relate to it in the same way I did with The Sopranos, in that I was fascinated by
this
The Sopranos, but everybody in The Sopranos, I was glad. I didn't want to be any of those people. Yes. My life was so much better than any of the characters in The Sopranos.
Ooh, good
and
point.
I kind of feel that way about Succession, even though they're fabulously wealthy. I wouldn't want to be any of those people. I'd rather be me.
Brian and I have sworn to each other. We're finishing up season one, but we swore to each other that we would not go ahead without the other one. So he's been gone a lot. So I am rewatching previous episodes. And then I think that really happened, whether it was the Murdochs or somebody.
Sure.
So then I'll stop. I'll Google that and go, oh, my God. And then I spin down that alley for half an hour. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So you never cheat. You never.
No, knock on wood.
Yeah.
Well, not in that way. Anyways, at least not on
of
Succession.
Course not. No. Well, because I believe that my wife and I have the same arrangement. And Yeah, it's difficult, you know, like especially with streaming, because you can do it, but then there's a party that wants to.
When binging
you know, your
finger
will shake over the remote control.
When binging first started, some brilliant person in Silicon Valley invented some kind of ring that you each wore, and if you went ahead
a fidelity ring, it
was like this stupid doorbell thing.
Well, I don't want to shock anybody, but Roberta and I have an open marriage, and I'm allowed to watch things on Netflix without her anytime I want, as long as I tell her about it afterwards. Just saying.
Don't bring anything home. Okay, Topi, I promise we'll talk about your book at one point.
Books,
okay,
probably.
This is great.
Last thing, speaking of entertainment, so because with Ms. McManus, I always feel like I should look at the bestseller list, which I do, and then I gag, except when Topi's book is on it, then we'll feel good. But I do like in the New York Times book review section, they have these things. We've decided it's all fake. Buy the book, and they interview some famous person, book-related things. What's on your nightstand? If you were an author, who would you be? Those kinds of things. Can anybody, if you read this, Ms. McManus, don't cheat.
It.
Okay, maybe you don't remember. What books are on Elton John's nightstand? Jamie?
I have to guess. Goodnight Moon.
It
was on everybody's book stand.
That would be good.
Writing love songs for dummies. I don't know.
Those would be practical. Remember we talked about the Salman Rushdie's, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Quixote?
Quixote, yeah.
Yeah, the reworking of Don Quixote.
Oh, he's reading that?
He claims. Again, we think I think his publicist wrote this, and he looked at it and said, yep,
he's
sure.
Thumbs up.
Yep. And the other one is by Ben Folds, a musician. It's called A Dream About Lightning Bugs.
I can believe that. Ben Folds a great musician.
I believe.
I think I've read about that book. I have not read that book, but
yeah. He organizes his books very well. He's very meticulous about this. It's the New York Times again. Huge library of books on art and photography, which I believe, kept in a gallery at his home in Windsor, of course. That's where we all keep our galleries. Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that's my favorite section. Okay. So speaking of award winning, and again, Toby gets the Nobel Prize, we'll be all for it. But a week or two ago, I guess we were talking, Ron Charles, The Washington Post. Have you met him yet?
Yes, I have.
He's fabulous.
He's a wonderful, wonderful person.
He's fabulous. Yeah, absolutely. And nobody wears a cockroach costume better than Ron Charles. Nobody.
He's at the top of my list, I must say.
Exactly. Yeah. What he does do for Halloween.
I mean, I think of these old chiseled book critics of the past, and then I think of Ron Charles. I'm like, he was really breaking the mold, isn't he?
So he had an article about the Nobel winners for literature, and there were two, and it was somewhat controversial because in 2018 they didn't give one, so they did the two this year, and it was very controversial, and I think he had a not completely pleasant experience in response to his article. But we started talking about these awards, and I have, well, two things. One, guess whose birthday it is today? October 21, when we're taping the show. Alfred Nobel.
Oh.
Which I think is amazing.
Of gunpowder.
Dynamite.
Dynamite, yes.
Yeah.
Which is related to why did he leave the money and say that it will all be used for these awards for various things?
He had a guilty conscience.
Kind of a guilty conscience. Yeah. He had a brother. He had a couple siblings. And one of his brothers dies. And when they did the obituary on the brother, they flipped his name in by mistake. Kind of a big one there, Miss Journalist, right? They flipped his name in by mistake, and they condemned this person for contributing to the deaths of so many people, because the whole family was involved in dynamite and other TNT-related type things. And Alfred Nobel evidently looked at it and was horrified. This is how people are going to remember me.
Yeah.
So he decided, I have to do something. And they were very, very wealthy. And that's how he decided to leave all this money and very specific instructions on how it should be awards for aspirational things in various elements of society.
Point of correction, it was a Chinese that invented gunpowder.
Okay, there you go.
Dynamite.
Yeah, you should know that. Another, okay. So anyway,
any school child knows.
It's his birthday. So it's a good day to be talking about this. I looked through the list of Nobel Prize winners for literary accomplishment and thought, I know maybe two names in that list. Ms. McManus?
Well,
any leap to mind?
I went through this. I was very thoughtful about this, actually. And
you're
always
thoughtful about things.
I thought about prize winning, and it's easy to be very dismissive of it.
As I was initially.
However, now that I'm a painter, and I try to compete in painting shows, I am so grateful to be juried into a show. That just means you get to hang your painting on a wall with like 50 other painters, okay?
Yeah.
So I think when you're a writer or an artist, a poet, you're working alone in your own world. And to have some sign of validation from your peers or your mentors is extremely meaningful. And so I will not be dismissive of awards or of people who want to win awards. And I went through all of the top awards. I went through Nobel, Pulitzer's, National Book Award. And I have to say, I saw a lot of differences. And one thing that really struck me was how the Pulitzer Prizes for Fiction, which are awarded to American authors, there's different limitations on different, as you know all about, from Kane Award, was way ahead of the pack for awarding women. Edna Ferber, Willa Cather. I mean, I think, like, it started in 1918, and there were, like, five women awarded in the first 7 or 8 years. So it's kind of mindful of that, and then mindful of minorities and mindful of, you know, sort of outside-the-box kind of awards. So suppose I don't know every Nobel Prize Award winner, and a lot of them are Europeans. I mean, it's a, sort of a European-based award. But I thought, I can understand why a writer, an artist would want this and would seek it aggressively.
Far less seriously than you. And we'll go to the one person at the table who's actually won a literary award, Tope, for the Kane Award for African Writing, 2013.
Indeed.
But at first I was like, you know, and I used to always say when industries and organizations start giving themselves prizes, that's when the industry is going downhill. and I think ones like the Nobel, Ron Charles' piece on this, apropos to that, but they probably get very political. I think those really, really big well-knowns tend to get very, very political, and they start trying to be political, and they end up serving nobody. But the more I thought about it, and the more I thought, because I struggle with this every week. And Ron Charles, remember telling us 300 books a day get dropped off the Washington Post or something like that? There are so many books out there. And how does the average person who wants to read and wants to read different things, how do you ever sort through it? For people like us, the awards are a helpful sorting mechanism. They curate for you.
Absolutely.
And that really makes a difference. And then I did start to read about what, to your point, Jeannie, just being in the competitions, being named, gets a young author noticed and gets them some support and gives them some legitimacy to keep going.
You're shortlisted, even if you don't win.
Toby, what was the process like for the Kane Award?
Let's see. So I had been writing in kind of complete obscurity for about like 4 or 5 years before I was shortlisted for the Kane Prize. So I don't have an MFA. I've never been to school for writing. And I had just this conviction that I wanted to become a writer. And so I was writing every day. One of my mentors, I'd been sending him my stories and probably
he was sick of it.
Yeah, I'm sure he was pretty sick of it. But I sent him one story and he said, I think this is a really strong story. You should submit it to the Kane Prize. And I was incredibly sort of excited that he said that. And so I asked my publisher to send it to the Kane Prize, and they did so. And so then I found out I was shortlisted. And so I was, you know, the least published person on the shortlist, the youngest person on the shortlist as well. And again, I was just elated because the fact that I was shortlisted meant that I was, you know, flown to London, spent a week traveling around places, reading, writing, doing all kinds of things, kind of engaging literary culture. And then I was fortunate enough to win. And you talk about like everything changing. I was at the awards ceremony, and I remember folks from the BBC and Reuters and some French media were there, and they announced that I'm the winner. And all of a sudden, you know, all these cameras are trained on me, and all of a sudden people care about what I have to say. And so I had published one story that was all of 4,000 words.
Wow.
And all of a sudden I became this kind of literary figure, which was incredibly sort of, you know, exciting, but also in some ways somewhat mystifying as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly changed my trajectory in a really profound way, because before then I had not been on anyone's radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden... people cared a little bit.
A lot of it, I think, has to do with how the awards are judged. You know, coming from a journalism background and being an award-seeking journalist, if not an award-winning journalist, you know, we all have seen awards given to people who didn't really deserve them, and we've also seen many, many really talented people who never are recognized with awards.
Yeah.
So when the two come together, somebody really talented is actually recognized, it's really kind of gratifying. But my, you know, my favorite awards story is the, you know, President Obama, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, was at the Alfred Smith dinner in New York one year. You know, you tend to do some self-deprecating humor there. And he was talking about his Nobel Peace Prize, and Henry Kissinger was in the audience. And he said, you know, Henry Kissinger is here, and he's in the front row there. And, you know, Dr. Kissinger and I have something in common. We both won the Nobel Peace Prize. He won his for ending the Vietnam War, and I won mine for, and then he looks to the side and he says, what did I win mine for?
But they did lower their credibility. The awards, they lowered their credibility by doing that. And he certainly probably should have deserved it 2, 3, 4 years in, but to give it to him at that stage.
So later on, I was at the Pentagon. Somebody gave me an award. The National Guard gave me an award for my coverage of National Guard stories. And by the way, if you're a journalist, the last thing you want is to get an award from the people you cover.
Yeah, bad sign,
Jane. What you really want is for them to call your editor and complain about an arrogant...
Because then you get a pay raise.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I wanted to be gracious, and I went, and I accepted this award. It was a little statue, and I said... I want to accept this award in the same spirit that President Obama accepted his Nobel Peace Prize, not so much for what I've done, but what I hope to do in the future. So,
nice. One of the reasons I was cynical, and again, reading about this has changed my opinion on it. I do think there was a place and a value to it, exactly what you're saying, Toby. But when I worked on the Hill, it just, thanks, honey. Bartender's here. one of the things that used to drive me crazy, and it would happen once a week. I worked for John McCain, press secretary. Some reporter would come in and sit down with you. Hey, got to talk to you about something. And if we did, whatever organization, if we did a series on commercial aircraft flying over the Grand Canyon, would John McCain hold a series of hearings and would he demand investigations and X, Y, and Z? And the reason they wanted to know that is because that enhanced their chances of winning awards.
Yeah.
And that's how they would decide what they would follow, how mm-hmm. they would follow it, what they would mm-hmm. do it. Once a week, somebody would come in and ask me that. Which I was like, so well, is that unlike, how you should be doing this?
Unlike a book award, which is based on an actual book.
Something exists.
Often the journalism awards are awarded not for the best journalism, but for the best awards presentation, submission.
Sure.
The most slickly thing. And
which
none
means
of the,
somebody's got too much time to spend putting that together.
And none of the claims that are made in those award things, which are often written not by the journalist, but from some PR department, are not, you know, like
I
this,
don't know.
This story started the biggest investigation ever and ended the corruption as we know it.
I don't think so. Just having been involved in getting texts together for awards, I found it very... The work speaks for itself. You don't need a slick presentation.
You think the ones that really deserve to win generally win the journalistic awards?
I do. And I mean, I think the post coverage of the opioid crisis, for example, is going to be a prime example.
Do you guys remember John McCaslin?
No.
Okay, journalist. Okay, for a story for another time. Okay, so Toby, again, this is part of the deal. We're talking to Toby Falerian in his wonderful book, A Particular Kind of Black Man, a novel. And I want to ask you about that subtitle. When you win that Nobel, you come back, we'll be very complimentary of the award, of
the
people
was
who presented the award.
Exactly. No one else deserved this. Exactly.
Long international study. They came up with the best winner. Claude,
I will say I predicted it.
I told you
several years ago.
Yeah, and we also have the red carpet rule. Any author who then gets a movie out of this, we get invited to premiere.
Oh, absolutely.
Done. Okay.
Absolutely.
Claude, let's take a break, and then we'll come back full time with Tope.
And the novel. Yep.
Yeah. We are back. It's Chatter on Books. And now we're going to spend the rest of the time almost talking to Tope Falerian, the wonderful person who has written this great book, A Particular Kind of Black Man, a novel. Topia, we love to do backstories, personal stories on people. Yeah. So, born in Utah, grew up in Texas.
Indeed. Grew up in Texas, went to middle school and high school in Texas, then I went to Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. I was fortunate enough to win a Rhodes Scholarship after Morehouse, so I went to Oxford for 2 years, earned 2 master's degrees.
That was just really fast.
Yeah.
You know,
Rhodes.
I never really got out of sixth
Oxford,
grade, so
degrees.
I'm still focused on. What was life like in Texas for you?
Oh,
shot
well,
of Nigerian immigrants.
Yes, Texas was really interesting. So part of the reason that my parents moved to Texas was because they were looking to move closer to other Nigerian immigrants. There is a large population of Nigerian immigrants in Houston and Dallas. And I think, frankly, that my parents were just very lonely.
Because in Utah, there was nobody.
Yes. Right. Yeah. There weren't.
Where did Utah come for them the first time?
My dad was at UCLA, and he was there on scholarship.
Okay.
And one of his very close friends was at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. And Weber State University was trying to raise its international profile. And so they were offering really generous scholarships to folks from abroad.
Okay.
And so my dad wasn't having the best time at UCLA. And he was talking with his friend on the weekend. And his friend said, hey, come over to Utah. Like, there, you can get this great education and they'll pay for it and it'll be fun. And so my dad didn't have the slightest idea where Utah was or what it was all about. He heard, you know, sort of money for school. I'll be hanging out with my best friend. And that was enough for him. And so he transferred after his first year at UCLA to Weber State and was immediately kind of sort of shocked by, you know, what Utah was and what it was all about. And, but decided to stay. I mean, as it happens, his friend, I think, left a couple of years afterwards. But, my dad came to like Utah. My dad often talks about like the importance of like living in a place with, he loved the Wasatch Mountains. And if you've ever been to Utah, they kind of like preside over everything. It's incredibly, I missed the Wasatch Mountains when we moved actually.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very drawn to the land for some reason. He was drawn to the people and he really felt he can make a life for himself there. And so I spent the first 13 years of my life in Utah and, didn't know, I thought the entire United States was like Utah. Utah is a fiercely patriotic place.
Right.
You know, every morning we would do the pledge and then we'd sing like like 5 or 6 patriotic songs. We were constantly learning about the founding of the country. And looking back, it makes sense because Utah was founded by people who traveled across the country, who fiercely believed in America, but fiercely believed as well in their own kind of, their personal faith.
And that kind of, those twin obsessions suffused everything in Utah. And so I was the beneficiary of people who kind of believed in the central kind of American idea that if you come to America, you can make it. I mean, I had teachers every grade from kindergarten through seventh grade. At least one teacher would take me aside and during the weekend take me to a museum or read to me or suggest books that I should read. And that's because they really believed in this notion that there was something special about America. Mm-hmm. And there were other kind of deprivations that we suffered over the course of our time in Utah. But there's no possible way I'd be sort of sitting here having this conversation and hadn't been for people who look nothing like me, different religion, different perspective. But there is a kind of, and I say this, I know we're not going to get political, but there is a kind of...
You can.
Okay, I can. Well, I have my politics, and, you know, and I do happen to be on the progressive side of things, but there were a number of conservative people who took me under their wing and cared for me and loved me. And so I am the beneficiary of that. And I think about that all the time. And I think it's because there's something intrinsic to the kind of culture of Utah that says that if you are here and you work hard enough, we're going to support you and ensure that you make it. And so when I won the Rhodes, the Utah newspapers were the first ones to call and to want to interview me and to talk about my sort of life, and well before the Texas or the Georgia newspapers. And that's because I think they felt, and somebody actually said to me that we feel like you're a son of Utah. So that was meaningful to me.
So not to get ahead of ourselves, but this book is a lot about identity.
Yeah, yeah.
So Utah sounds like it was really important to your identity.
It was, in a way, absolutely. I mean, in many important ways, I am a Utahn. I can't deny that. I mean, my formative years were spent there. But I think what happened for me in Utah was that I was at the kind of center of a collision of a number of stories. One story is my parents are from Nigeria, and they're Nigerians. And my dad, you know, even though one of his proudest moments and mine as well is when he wanted to become a citizen. And so my dad was studying for the exam that prospective citizens have to take. And he was asking me to help him on that exam. I was like 7 or 8. And so he said, you know, do you know the preamble to the Constitution? I did. We had memorized it in school. So I taught him the preamble. Place that aside, my dad was still in terms of the way he saw the world, in Nigerian. And so there was this Nigerian story. In Utah, there's this kind of fiercely kind of American story and also a Mormon story. We are select. We are elect. We are set aside from the rest of the country. We are the chosen people, right? And then I'm growing up, phenotypically, I'm a black person. So a lot of people are convinced I'm an African American, but I don't have the slightest idea what that is. But they impose that identity on me. And so I'm at the nexus of these three stories. And because I have a two-year-old now, what I recognize in parenting her is that part of what I'm doing is transmitting a story to her of who she is and what she is and how she fits in this country. And my dad tried to do the same, but he wasn't equipped in certain ways to kind of place me in this space because his story and mine cannot be aligned. He came as an immigrant. He still had this entire place that was very important to him that he evoked and that he constantly referenced when I was growing up. And so for that reason, I was kind of lost from a kind of story perspective. And the novel is really about a character who's trying to create for himself a story that makes sense, because J.M. Coetzee, we were just talking about the Nobel Prize, right. It's the great sort of Nobel winning writer from South Africa who now resides in Australia, has this line that always resonates with me. He says that each of us are walking stories, and I think that's entirely the case. And that is, sometimes we hear a story that kind of conflicts with our stories, and we respond to that from a story perspective. So I didn't inherit a story that like made sense for me as I was growing up.
What did your Rhodes Scholarship in Oxford, most of us don't do either one of those, I just remind everybody, contribute to your story?
You know, Rhodes was the first, Oxford was the first place where I could truly, fully be myself. And that might sound odd, you know, in some ways. But the great thing about an Oxford education is that you have basically one class a week. You meet with your tutor, and your tutor will assign a paper and say, you know, go off and read these 20 books, write a paper, come back, and we'll evaluate the paper together. And you send the paper right before the meeting. You go sit with the tutor. It's marked up and read. You know, your tutor's like, okay, you think about this, you think about that. But for the most part, you're left to your own devices. So I had just swaths of time that I could, you know, read and engage with myself. And part of it too is that I am the son of Nigerian immigrants. And I don't know if you've ever been around Nigerian immigrants, but the one thing they want to do is like brag about their kids. You know, if you go to a Nigerian gathering, you'll see a bunch of Nigerians like in the most conspicuous way imaginable, like bragging about my kid's at Yale. Oh, my kid's at Harvard. My kid's at Princeton. And so the first thing I did when I won the Rhodes is that I thought, I've given my dad something he can sort of take to these parties. That's my first thought. And I thought, like, okay, what do I actually want to do with my life? Because up to that point, I just wanted to satisfy him. I wanted him to be proud of me. I wanted him to, you know, be able to stand toe to toe with these other parents and say, my kid is doing something impressive and important. And so one of the first things that happened when I got to Oxford was I was at a party and some of my friends were talking about the latest Philip Roth novel. And I was kind of shocked because I didn't know I was allowed to do that. Right before I left for Oxford, I spent a lot of time like sort of memorizing the head of state for each country. I was reading like foreign policy. I was, you know, I just wanted to ensure that when I went there, I could, you know.
Everything in the lanes in terms
precisely,
of study.
That's yeah. exactly mm-hmm. it. I wanted to ensure that people wouldn't think of me as an imposter. I was very obsessed with that. And I wanted to get the right pronunciations as well. It's not Magdalen College, it's Magdalen College. I mm-hmm. wanted to ensure that I wouldn't seem like I was sticking out. And so to go to a party at Oxford and sort of day three, and people are talking about art, which is something that I'd always secretly loved. I love art. And I loved, you know, reading. And actually, when I was at Morehouse, I was so convinced that my reading habit would sort of prevent me from reaching the promised land that I stopped reading fiction for a moment. So, but here I am with all my peers who read lots and lots of fiction, who talk about it in really sophisticated and interesting ways. And then I thought, okay, so now I can indulge this kind of desire that I've been repressing for so many years. And so
what
I was
off to the races. What did you all of a sudden start reading? And
I read everything.
You know,
I
started. You didn't have a canon that you had to follow like you did.
No. Yeah. I was left to my own devices. So I started like by going to the local museum and I spent a lot of time there. And I found that I was really drawn to modern art. I hadn't spent much time at all, like really, you know, kind of gazing at paintings, but I was looking at paintings by Kandinsky and Braque and Picasso and, you know, the surrealist Dali, you know, the futurist from Italy, the constructivist from Russia. And I found that for some reason that art really spoke to me. And so then I thought, what's the kind of literary analog to what I'm seeing in the museum? And so I started reading a lot of, you know, like the modernists who were writing at that point as well. You know, obviously folks like Hemingway, you know, the entire brood of Americans who went to Paris and began to kind of create a new kind of literature. I was very Proust's obviously was precedes them, but was part of that movement as well. So I read all of that stuff and then I got into theater. I was going to lots and lots of plays. So I started reading Pinter. He became somebody I was obsessed with. So I read everything. And then, of course, my second master's is in African studies. And my dad, when I was
growing up.
Let me
just stop you there. Second master's. Just saying. Go ahead.
So my second master's, I started reading a lot of the African writers that uh-huh. I hadn't read much when I was growing up. So Chinua Achebe, Wole Soyinka, Bessie Head. I read everything that I could get my eyes on. And so I was really at an interesting kind of point because at the end of my second year, that's when people start deciding what they're going to do post-Oxford. And I was like, many of my friends, they were sort of obsessed with trying to get into some of the consulting firms. And I'm doing those case studies as well. I, you know, McKinsey, BCG. And then Google comes on campus and they give us this like great presentation. And I decide I want to work at Google. But at that point, I was still thinking about like the possibility of pursuing a literary career.
What did you want to be at Google?
Well, I'm interested in public policy as well. My first master's degree is in comparative social policy, which is at least at that point, a kind of British version of public policy. And so I was interested in doing public policy at Google. And
they could use your help right now. Just
well, yeah. As it happens, a lot of the thorny issues they're grappling with now are issues that I dealt with when I was, you know, at Google. I was in their London office, so I had to do 7 interviews on a couple continents, and it's a very rigorous kind of process. And at the end of this, you know, they kind of give you the golden key and say, "Here you are." And I made it abundantly clear that I was interested in art, and they said they'd give me like a book stipend. They aggressively recruited me and said, you know, if you want to, you know, do these things, you can do these things here at Google. And so, but then I got to Google and I was working 80 hours a week. It was a fantastic job, I have to say. You know, I was traveling. Mm-hmm. I was based in London, but I was always at Heathrow. I spent the bulk of my time in Turkey, which is interesting, you know, for any number of reasons today, but Ankara and Istanbul, also Israel, Haifa, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv. And so I spent most of my time in those places, but also Eastern Europe. I was in Romania a bunch of times, other places as well. And so I'm traveling all over the world. And I'm seeing the world in a way that, you know, many of my friends can. And I'm also like, because Google was so young in Europe at that point, what would often happen was that some, you know, person would say, you know, so this happened in Turkey a lot. I'm shutting down the internet because, you know, the Turks are very, very sensitive about Ataturk. You know, don't say a bad word about Ataturk. If you do, we're going to shut down the internet. So the Greeks would like, you know, some prankster from Greece would say something bad about Ataturk on YouTube, like Ataturk's gay. They would shut down the internet. Then my boss would come to my cubicle and say, you're in Ankara tomorrow. I jump on a plane and then I, you know, kind of pitch them on the importance of, you know, freedom of information on the web before, you know, the big guns from Silicon Valley could make it in. And so I was often in rooms with very sort of, you know, accomplished people. And that was invigorating and exciting as well. You know, I was all of 25 and here I am, you know, speaking at, you know, I'm in Israel speaking with the head of state about, he's upset about the way that, you know, engineers in Silicon Valley have apportioned, you know, certain parts in the Middle East. He's convinced that, you know, is, you know, there's a kind of mm-hmm. Palestinian takeover happening online and he wants to rebut that. So that was incredibly exciting. But I, as time passed, you know, I'm making a great salary. My dad can brag about me to his friends. My son's working at Google, he says all the time, in his deep bass. But the question became, like, am I actually doing something that I want to do? And so I reached a point when, you know, my second year there, I'm on a plane to Turkey, and I'm writing furiously, like I'm trying to write a short story. And the person in the seat next to me at a certain point says, because I write the entirety of the flight, he says, whatever you were doing for the, you know, hours that we were on the flight is what you should spend the rest of your life doing. And I, that
really?
Was very profound for me.
What kind of person was this sitting next to you?
He was a Turkish businessman. So we were sitting right next to each other, and he had tried to engage me in conversation at the outset, and I kind of politely, I hope, you know, said, yeah. And then I kept on writing. And then he kind of looked at me. It was like one of those moments that happened, I think, to all of us. He looked at me as the plane was taxiing, and he said, whatever you were doing, you should spend the rest of your life doing that.
No, no one's ever said that to me. Anybody?
Anybody? Don't you want to go back and find him?
I think I should.
I'm seeing where this is going. So given this, you have this great job at Google, and then you decide, no, I'm going to go for the money and pursue the high-paying career
field. That's exactly what happened.
Literary.
I don't have to say anymore.
How did you take it when he said that?
Well, you know, the fact that it rhymed with something that was happening inside meant the world to me, because I was thinking that as well, but I didn't have the courage to say it out loud.
Uh-huh.
And so the fact that, like, my sort of internal beliefs were externally confirmed meant the world to me. Then 3 weeks later, I got this great bonus from Google, and I thought, well, you know, the universe is trying to tell me something.
They were listening.
Yeah.
They were listening to that conversation on the plane.
But then what happened? This was 2008. I come to the States. I wanted to come to a place that was somewhat analogous to London, which is to say, like, free museums, because I love going to the museum, a great theater scene, lots of bookstores about so I could go watch writers. So DC for me became the place to come. So I'd never lived here before. I came here sight and seen. And then 3 or 4 months later, the market crashes. So by October, you know, Lehman Brothers goes down, the market crashes. And, for the next basically year and a half, I'm unemployed. And this for me was he was beside himself.
Yeah.
And the arts took a big hit.
That's exactly it. And so I'm writing in my room by myself. I'm sending my work out. No one's accepting it. I had an Excel spreadsheet in which I kind of notched how many rejections I received. And before I published my first story, it was 100+ rejections. And so there were many moments of crisis during that point when I thought, like, why am I doing this? Nobody wants to read my work. I've left this job that was lucrative. All my friends are still gainfully employed. I'm still going on Facebook and seeing them, you know, like their happy pictures from wherever they are. And I'm here in this room by myself. And, you know, what am I doing? And my dad and I didn't talk for about 6 months because he was convinced I was become the wayward son. I'd become the black sheep of the family.
Wow.
And then we've spoken some about the Kane Prize. That came after this period of kind of, you know, enforced separation from everyone else. And so the Kane Prize was something I desperately needed. And I won, and I called my dad from London, the first call I made, from Oxford, actually. And my dad said, I've been telling you your entire life to write, and look what happened to you when you start writing. So I said, okay.
So if this were a movie,
this is exactly where it would end.
Yeah. Exactly.
It would end with this triumphant success, and then we would never find out what happened later when he went into slow slide again.
Okay. But commercial break, we could find that guy who was sitting next to you on the plane.
That would be incredible.
We could narrow down the month, week.
Can I also just point out that there's a slight cultural difference with Nigerian parents and say, it's like, I don't want to speak for all Jews, but my mom, who was a New York Jew, when I remember I called her and told her I'd gotten this great assignment at CNN. I was going to be covering the Pentagon. And my mom says to me, well, what will that lead to? And I said, well, Mom, it's a pretty good gig. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
She said, so she says, well, do you think you'll be Secretary of Defense one day? I said, Mom, I'm a journalist. I hardly think that would qualify me to be Secretary of Defense. She says, so you have no ambition? There's a slightly different dynamic. That's all I'm saying.
You know, that job could be open soon, Jamie. You might still.
I might be qualified for it now. I wasn't then.
My dad still says to me, so what are you going to do with your life? It's gonna, we're kind of on the back nine, Pops. This is as good as it's going to get. So I have so many, we might just need to keep everybody for another 40 minutes. So, Toby, the book is A Particular Kind of Black Man, a novel. It's a lot about you.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But what was the particular inspiration for this book?
Well, I love literature. And mm-hmm. so there were two things I think operating for me is one, that I hadn't encountered a story that kind of mirrored mine. And for me, that's important as somebody who loves Toni Morrison. She often says, and she's been quoted a number of times saying, like, if you haven't sort of seen a story that is represents you, then write it. And so for me, that was a motivation.
Why a novel instead of autobiographical?
Yeah, I think that's I think part of it is that I had, as a fiction writer, my objective is to ensure that there's a story that works and resonates with people, right? And so when I'm doing that, I will stray from my life at certain critical points as I do in this book. For me, it's a mode of communication with the reader. I think a memoir is more about transmitting my life as it happened. And that for me wasn't the concern. I think part of what I'm interested in, and I became somewhat interested in this when I started working at Google, is that, and actually my research before I went to Google was about the way that we construct our identities on the web. I think that millennials and folks who are younger have a kind of different conception of identity than other people do, perhaps. And I think that I think that what the web presents is an opportunity to construct an identity that matches who you are in very important ways. I can go on the web, and if I'm living in this small town somewhere in the middle of the country and you know, no one kind of gets who I am or where I'm coming from, I can find a community online that does get who I am and where I come from. And so I can align myself in a very kind of strident way with these people, right? And so I think that that's what I was interested in, that story. Like, how do we construct identity in the 21st century? And so I wanted to tell that from a kind of novelistic perspective, because mm-hmm. I thought that if it was a novel, I could focus squarely on that question in a way that I couldn't if it was a memoir, because then I'd have to sort of focus on then this happened, then this happened, then this uh-huh. happened. So because of that focus, I thought that the novel was maybe the best. And the novel is capacious enough to kind of hold the real and the unreal as well in a way that memoir isn't, right? Like, if I write a memoir and I, you know, fib here and there, somebody will call me out. But in a novel, I can sort of, you know, tell some details of my life, and I can also articulate a truth that isn't necessarily wedded to facts, but that's wedded to the human condition,
right?
Which is what artists try to do.
Which I get. Now I'm fascinated with your father, and we need to have you come in. Remember Mike Crowley from Denison? Uh-huh. It's the story about his father. Mm-hmm. What did your father think of this? Because clearly parts of it are autobiographical.
Yeah.
Based on what you were telling us, Utah, your experience, Utah, Texas, et cetera, your upbringing seemed a lot happier, a lot more positive than Tunde in the book.
Yeah.
How did your father feel about this? And did he read and go, wait a minute, is that what you thought of your childhood?
Yeah, he hasn't read the book, and I'm not sure if he will, partly because,
wow.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think he recognizes that even if I depart from the facts at certain points in the book, that the spirit of who he is in some ways is captured in that. And, uh-huh. and I have deep admiration for my father. Part of what I think about when I think about him is somebody who is fiercely ambitious, who was talented, who was also, you know, very, very smart, but for various reasons wasn't able to achieve what he wanted to achieve. And so my father was one of those who kind of invested a great deal in his kids. I mean, he had a very regimented schedule for us. And so from the moment we woke up to the moment we went to sleep, every hour was scheduled, every minute was scheduled. And he made us, you know, we had to have elocution classes. We had handwriting classes. He wanted to ensure that we had the best penmanship in school.
It's a tiger mom.
He was before he was. And I think now looking back, I recognize that part of the reason why he did this was because his own ambitions were thwarted in certain important ways.
Sure.
And so he wanted to ensure that his kids were the kind of perfect you know, sort of candidates for success in this country. And he studied all the time, you know, who's successful? Why are they successful? And so he transmitted a lot of those lessons to us. And I think that for him, you know, reading the book might be a kind of encounter with something, with maybe part of his failure. And I think as he's kind of moved on from that, he's happy with his kids and his mm-hmm. grandkids now, and they're all, you know, doing well. And I'm not sure if he wants to confront, like, what was a very difficult point in his life.
And I've heard you talk about pressure early on yeah. from agents who liked what they saw in your work, but wanted you to make it a story about your father,
yeah.
to make it an immigrant novel.
Absolutely.
And you persisted and
yeah.
said, no,
yeah.
it's not about that. It's a novel about identity and about finding your identity, which
yeah.
I think is so important in this book, because there, first of all, there's this now a big wave of immigrant literature, which is very interesting and wonderful. And I've read some of the books and it's just opened up my eyes to this whole world.
Yeah.
But yours is so singular, I think, in the way that you write about this young man carving his identity out of the most unlikely places and the most, you know, compelling circumstances.
Yeah.
And so tell me how you resisted that pressure, because probably would have been easy. Oh, yeah, here's another immigrant novel.
It was hugely difficult. It was so difficult, especially when, you know, my agent sent out the novel about maybe 5 years ago. And a number of editors responded in a really robust way. And they said, we love your writing. We love this character in particular, Tunde's father. And one editor, who I won't name, said, somebody who I admired said, you know, if you center the novel around this character, I can, you know, give you a great advance and promise you the kind of tour that you want and everything else. And you know, I have to be honest, I just derived a lot of courage. And looking back, this makes complete sense to me. Part of the reason why I spent so much time in the museum focused on the moderns was because I was interested in artists who made a leap, who were interested in sort of going against whatever the prevailing sentiment was about the way art should be made and kind of stuck to their guns. You know, I vividly remember going to the Philadelphia Museum of Art because there was an exhibition of the Impressionists and Durand Ruel, who was their dealer. He was the one person who kind of invested in a number of these folks when they had no money, no connections, whatever else. He was the one person who said, keep doing what you're doing. And there are a number of instances like that. And so I was interested in kind of doing the leap. And I knew because of my name, where my parents are from, the kind of story I had, that people would want to kind of force me into this lane.
Americana.
Precisely, yes. If I can't tell you how many kind of DC house parties I've been to where someone sees my name, they're like, oh, your parents are from Nigeria. Oh, do you know Chimamanda? Yeah. And so like, she's kind of established this lane, right?
Sure.
Yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing about her is that when she published her first book back in 2004, she was in a similar place because there wasn't any, like, African writing that was doing well. And so she was, in her own way, kind of pioneer. And then with her, you know, she had her first book, Purple Hibiscus, that did really well. And then her second book, Half of a Yellow Sun. I remember when Purple Hibiscus came out, I was among those who was like passing the book around to my friends saying, you have to read this. This is really important, because nobody cared that much about African fiction. But now we're at a point where a lot of people do. But publishers, because they're publishers and they want to make money, they want a lot of people to kind of, you know, do similar kind of stories in a way. And so I think part of my job as an artist is to resist that impulse. You know, conformity is very lucrative. But I think if you have, I spend a lot of time thinking about craft, trying to be the best writer I can be. And I think, too, about like for me, one question is, what are the important stories of the 21st century? And I'm convinced that one of them is identity construction. You know, it's not a coincidence. You have a number of people who are saying, you know, I am trans, I am actually this person, or people who are sort of stepping boldly out of the closet. And part of what's happening is that people are saying, you know, I feel for the first time that I have an opportunity to be who I actually am, not who the community thinks I am, not who the country thinks I am, but who I actually am. And so, and a lot of people might reject that impulse and say, well, you have to conform. But I think it's one of the major and most important stories of this century. And so because I believe that, I wanted to tell a story that is about that as well, that is intrinsically human because I'm a human and Tunde is a human. But that speaks to kind of some of those things that are happening to a lot of us right now.
I'm in awe. Okay. How'd you learn how to write so well? we read a lot around here. And there's not a wasted word. Where did you learn how to write?
Well, I mentioned my period of unemployment, which at the time I was very deeply ashamed about. But, you know,
my kids have been unemployed. I promise you, they did not turn into spectacular writers in that period in which they were unemployed.
You know, my dad, you know, he had us on schedules. And so that's what I did when I was unemployed. I said, you know what? I have all this time. I have this really great girlfriend who's not kicking me out to the curb, who's not my wife. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to structure my day. And so I'd spend 4 hours reading anything I could, 4 hours writing. And I spent 4 hours engaging with art, whatever that meant. So sometimes I go to an art lecture at the National Gallery of Art or the Hirshhorn or the Smithsonian American Art Museum, or I'd watch a film. I love cinema as well. And so I watched as many films as I could. Part of this came because when I was at Oxford, one of the people I read was Susan Sontag. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how she became an artist. And she said that part of what she did was that she immersed herself in the art world. She took in everything she could. And her thinking was that there was always a bank of image and sort of words that she could draw from when she was composing her own work. And so I took that to heart, and I thought that maybe I can do the same for myself. And And so I engage with everything, you know, and there's like a wonder in that, because initially you might be sitting in the lecture and you're not interested in what this person is saying or the art that they do. But then as the lecture progresses, you think, oh, wow, like there's a connection to what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're interested in kind of learning more. And so I was just very, very disciplined about writing every day. Very, very disciplined about going on YouTube and you know, listening to my favorite art writers and artists talk about their craft and trying to implement that as well. And so I think this kind of period of enforced separation from everything else was incredibly important because I was forced to become a better artist during that period.
Okay, I'm sure there's something very disciplined behind it, but this is awful for a podcast because you can't see, but you're reading the book and it's page after page after page. And then you get to page 197, and instead of lots of words on a page, then there are a handful of words.
Yeah.
I hope I'm describing it. And then you turn the page and there are just a couple of words. And then there are a few pages in which the same word is repeated many, many, many times. What's the motivation behind that?
Yeah. So I think that part of what happens is that Tunde at that point, and I'm not giving anything away when I say this, I think, is that he has decided that he wants to construct his, he says that he's been writing about his past. He can't trust his own memories because for any number of reasons, he's concerned that maybe his recall isn't what it should be. And so he says, I'm going to write about this character. And that's what it starts that way. He's writing about a character who has his name and perhaps has his past. But then as he continues to write about this character, he discovers that maybe he's writing about himself in the future. So that was part of the motivation. Two, because I've seen so many films and read so many books about love, you know, like there's Hollywood depicts love in a very particular way. You know, like the violins start, you know, they get louder and the images get really gauzy and people are prancing through fields and that's how falling in love is. But my experience of falling in love was that the world kind of reduced itself to two points, me and the person with whom I was falling in love. And so I wanted to capture that on the page. Like, what does it mean? I remember this very intense period when I was falling in love with my wife and I just stopped caring about other things. And I remember like talking with myself and thinking like, this is not very healthy. Like I have to go to class. I have to continue with my life. You know, like this is ridiculous. But I just, for those first 2 or 3 months, it was very intense, like sense that the world revolved around us two. And so I wanted to like, as this character begins to fall in love, I wanted to capture that on the page in a way that I hadn't seen before. And so I have so many pounds and pounds of like attempts at trying to get this right. And this is what I settled on.
You know, it's wonderful. And because it really does keep you going. And sometimes, I don't know who we were talking about recently, Gina, about this. Sometimes you can tell an author just wants to get the book done. And you can just tell. And you can tell the last chapter or two is like, oh, I just have to get through this, man, right? And there was such attention and such care paid to it. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Toby, it's a wonderful book. It really is. This was a real, for me, it was start reading, don't stop. Just keep reading until you're done. Really, really wonderful. It's called A Particular Kind of Black Man, a novel. We usually ask people like you, okay, who's going to play you in the movie? But now I'll ask you, who's going to play your father in the movie?
That's a great question. Wow. Who will play my father? I mean, you know, my father, I think maybe someone like Morgan Freeman, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone like that.
Voice of God?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. Claude, let's take a break. We'll come back with a quick deserted island. We're back. It's Chatter on Books. We've been talking to Tope Falerin with this wonderful book, A Particular Kind of Black Man, a novel. Lori's taken mine. She's taken hers home. It's really, we say this, we've had a lot of really good authors and a lot of really good books, but this one is something people really should read. Because to your point, Ms. McManus, there are lots of these immigrant story books now. This is really something. So Tope, thank you for writing it. And we owe a real debt of gratitude to that guy in the plane.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
If he hadn't said that to you in the plane, would you still be working for Google?
Probably.
Testifying before Congress and we would be hating you.
So many of my close friends still do. And yeah.
Okay.
Wait a minute. When you say that, does that mean you don't have to read all those other books from the previous shows?
I not only read all of them. If there's an audio version, I listen to the audio version as well. Yeah, I really do. Okay. So this is Deserted Island, which goes lots of different ways. And thanks to Claire. Thank you, Claire, for being here. We had a fun conversation going with some of the Facebook friends about personal recommendations for books. And I do get asked this now. I'll be sitting somewhere talking and they go, whoa, if you do this stupid podcast, you know what? I need a book for so and so. So we had a couple of people email me and say, okay, here's the kind of book I need for the kind of person I need. I'm going to throw the first one to Jamie because I know what the answer is. This was from Patrick, and I think he did it as a joke to me because I hate dystopian stuff. I hate it when my kids read it. I hate it that they were reading it. I hate it that I was paying school's big boatloads of money for them to read this garbage. So I think it was kind of a joke of him to me saying, Tori needs to make a recommendation on a dystopian book, which I can't. So Jamie.
So you threw this out to me.
Jamie.
I was like scratching my head.
He's the
course,
first alternate.
Think
give it
was,
to him.
Was movies with like Will Smith in them or something. And then I thought, no, I think the most trenchant dystopian novel of our time is The Mueller Report. If you've actually
everyone
read it,
everyone should read it.
Everyone should read it because we are living in very strange times.
Yeah. Ms. McManus has read it. I have read it.
Yeah.
You don't sleep when you read that. Just read the first couple hundred pages and you go, yeah. It
the
really
first
is.
Volume.
And, well, part two is interesting as well.
Yeah. And Donna Brazile. It's not Bob Mueller, Donna Brazile. But Donna's book, Hacked, which was the third or fourth, she was the third or fourth author we had on the show, and she didn't talk at all about her book because she talked about cooking because it was Thanksgiving. That book, too, people should pay attention to
and
what she said
Senate
in there.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has just released an 85-page report that's very readable. There's a lot of redaction, so it makes it easier to get through.
Idiot's faster. Guide to the Mueller Report.
And it's also just, it's basically about just how the Russians are, these Russian trolls and bots are trying to set us against each other.
Yeah, and succeeding.
And succeeding.
Disinformation
and
campaigns.
I resent the way you said that.
Okay, Jeannie, what was the one I had for you? Remind me.
Someone wanted a recommendation for her
21-year-old niece, fine arts major, about to graduate, won't have any job, so have lots of free time, and wants a book about art of some kind.
Well, this is so pertinent to the discussion we've just had with Tope about the sort of fork in the road that you face if you're an artist or a writer, and she's assuming fine art.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
She's maybe she's a graphic designer, but
sounded like
cinema.
Sounds like painting.
Help her. So I would say to her to read Range by David Epstein about how generalists fit in a specialist world. And although she's a specialist, if she wants a job,
right,
she might be able to go into a field that she's not familiar with and give some added value to that field with her fine arts degree. But the other thing is that she should stick to her guns and try to be an artist. And I think if you listen to Tope's discussion about the discipline that's required about becoming an artist, that would be very helpful. That, 4 hours of this, 4 hours of this. And I would say to her, keep a paintbrush in your hand at all times, or a pencil, or a sketchbook, or whatever. But I think the one thing that is helpful to me is to read artists' biographies.
Mm-hmm.
Just pick one up. I think in particular of Matisse, who lived a particularly long life. Yeah. I think he was 88 or something when he died. And he was rebuffed. He wasn't allowed into the salon. He started his own group with the Fauves, which really pressed up against traditional painting practices. He was laughed out of the art world for this portrait that he drew of his wife with a big green line down her nose, which is a complete masterpiece. But he also, in his 88 or 89 years, I can't remember, kept reinventing.
He's only up to Q in the Encyclopedia Britannica at 88 or 89.
He kept reinventing himself in ways that were sometimes exceptional and sometimes not so exceptional, but basically kept on moving down the line.
Yeah.
And being curious.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And even like when he was a frail old man sitting in bed cutting out shapes that made mosaics and made a beautiful stained glass window in a cathedral.
Because he had a handicap at that point, right?
He couldn't walk.
They gave him safety scissors. It wasn't the sharp ones. It was safety scissors.
You said when you're seeking career advice, the advice that if you keep at it, you'll succeed when you're 80 is not all that inspiring.
No, he had many successes.
And people, as a semi-successful journalist, young people, and I also taught journalists, and they also say, how do I break into, how do I be a success? And of course, what you what you know is that you actually can't tell anybody how to succeed. What you can do is tell them what you did and what other people did. And the only common theme is perseverance and persistence.
That's right.
And there's no guarantee because life isn't fair. And just because you're really talented and a great writer, it doesn't mean you're going to succeed. And we all know people who can't sing who are great, successful pop singers.
No, it's true. And I thought listening to this person's story in the request, also if she's 21 years old, there are a lot of different ways she could take her interest. Read Walter Isaacson's book on Da Vinci.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
First of all, amazing that Walter Isaacson could pull off something like that. Yeah. But Da Vinci did a million different things and worked incredibly hard at it.
And he didn't even have the opportunity to be a social media influencer,
which was a job that wasn't available.
And there are also several good books about managing yourself as an artist, about the business of being an artist, about setting up your website, about finding a way to eliminate the whole gallery system, which, you know, can work against you. So she should do that too. But I mean, Tope, you can probably speak more eloquently about the advantages of like going to a Google for a while. And there's value to that too.
1,000%. Yeah. I mean, learning to work. I mean, I had to work really hard. I had a very structured life at Google. And I was able to, you know, to be perfectly honest, I was able to save money as well.
Mm-hmm.
I made great connections while I was there.
So my advice is get a Rhodes Scholarship and 2 master's degrees.
Exactly.
Work at Google for a while and then
you can
write
do whatever you
book.
Want.
How hard can that be?
Life works out then.
Okay, the last one was from Tracy, who says, my mother, a chef, doesn't read. She'll retire soon. And my siblings and I are worried about what she will do with all her time. Any books that she might actually read because she doesn't read and ease the transition. And I go immediately, and it's in the other room here, Bill Buford's book, Heat, which has got to be 15, 20 years old.
Love that book.
He made that transition from editing fiction.
Yes, he was at the New Yorker, kept trying to convince everybody to do a story on the then one of the big stars in New York, Mario Batali, and just the restaurant scene in general, because it was becoming very hot and very big, and they wouldn't. And so he did it, and he became an intern and an apprentice.
It's incredible.
He would work in these kitchens that were insane. He would go to Italy, learn how to make pasta. There was the Dante quoting guy from Tuscany.
Yeah.
Absolutely fabulous
if
book.
If you just read that book, you will never throw out your pasta water.
Ever.
You ever. Just keep it on the stove at all times.
Yeah. That's so funny. That was my big takeaway, too. Excellent.
That is like liquid gold.
That's great. He did another great one, Among the Thugs, which I think is not too far. We don't structure our books the way Elton John does. But he wrote a book called Among the Thugs back when there actually were hooligans at English soccer matches.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just going to go and essentially do a story on the thugs, and he started following them. He became one of them. And it's just remarkable. As it goes on, he embedded himself, Jamie, with the thugs to observe them more closely, but he found himself turning into one of these animals.
Wow.
He was great. He's a talented guy.
He is, absolutely.
Okay. But Tope, you're more talented.
Oh, well.
And when you win those awards, we want you to come back. Thank you for being here
Please
with us.
Have me back.
Absolutely fabulous.
I'd love to come back.
We
Thank
will.
You so
so
much.
Enjoyable.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you can come be a person in the table too. You don't have to just be an author. So
Wonderful.
A little housekeeping. Go to Calvert Woodley. What's Michael's new thing? Nationals 5. To get $5 off at checkout. Claude, thanks for making everything happen.
Thank you, Claude.
Claire and Dina and Bobby and everybody, Lori and Dan and Ms. Ginz, thank you for coming on your one leg there. Happy to have you here. We are back in a week with Steve Vogel, formerly of the Washington Post.
Yes.
Great true story about Berlin and spies in Berlin. So come back next week.
Great.
Go Nats!